Been found not guilty of defrauding them. The defence team at the trial of the accused sisters introduced claims of drug taking by the TV chef, which police say they won't investigate unless there's new evidence. Anita Better and Francesca Grillo insisted all their purchases on a company credit card had been authorised. Their solicitor Richard Cannon spoke outside Isleworth Crown Courts.
My clients are naturally relieved at the verdict of the jury. This has been a long, hard fight, played out in the gaze of the world's media.
Police have confirmed a body found in a disturbed grave in Oxfordshire is the missing teenager Jaden Parkinson. The discovery was made in Didcot after a tip-off. The man has appeared in court charged with murdering the 17-year-old. Two soldiers, including one who was based at the same barracks as Fusilier Lee Rigby, have been jailed for 6 years for firebombing a mosque in Grimsby. Stuart Harness and Gavin Humphreys attacked the building 4 days after the Woolwich murder. Some Syrian chemical weapons will be brought to the UK to be decommissioned. They'll be unloaded from a ship here and incinerated. Surveyors say the ceiling of the London Apollo Theatre is sound, despite 10 square metres of plaster falling onto the audience. 79 people were injured last night. Luis Suarez has ended the latest speculation on his future and signed a new long-term contract at Liverpool. The highly controversial Uruguayan striker suggested in the summer that he wanted a move away from the club. These Liverpool fans are delighted he's staying.
I've watched Liverpool for over 60 years and he's one of the greatest forwards I have ever seen.
Some of the stuff he was coming out with, I think he was a bit disrespectful to the club. He's more than made up for that now.
Just the fact that he signed for the next few years, it just shows the way the club wants to move forward.
Npower is paying up to £3.5 million to help vulnerable customers. The energy regulators found the company has breached energy sales rules. That's the latest. I'm Nick Qureshi.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2. 93.2. The station you can count on.
It's Friday, 5 o'clock, and BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. Politicians have all been sent off on their holidays now. Hooray! So helping us review this week's news is freelance journalist and author of Who Owns Britain, Kevin Carhill. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, Work and Pensions Secretary Ian Duncan Smith slips out of the chamber as the House of Commons debates food banks, leaving his assistant Esther McVeigh to carry the can. There's nothing, we're told, she can do to put food on our tables except encourage those cut off from benefits, disabled, mentally ill too, to go and get a job. BBC Points West reports 70 or so people every night sleeping rough in a rainy Bristol city centre, while thousands of acres of office space stand empty. Tony Crofts is back with the latest from his housing group, Abolish Empty Office Buildings. Plus, what if every soldier in the world were given the order to put down their gun, hop out of their tank and shake the hand of the enemy over a drink? Sounds ridiculous, but on Christmas Day back in 1914, soldiers in World War I did it of their own accord. Somerset woman Freya Lawton joins us and she's determined to make it happen. Plus, Martin Summers really does this week take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. Well, that is in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 8 Celsius, showers, some heavy and gusty winds. This weekend, highs around 11, showers during the weekend, some heavy and also strong winds. Next week, highs around 9 Celsius, wet and windy at the beginning of the week, brighter towards the end of the week. Over Christmas Day and Boxing Day, it's looking dry and mild with hazy sunshine. Next weekend, 28th and 29th of December, highs of 5 Celsius, sunny, but feeling colder. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, helping us review this week's news is freelance journalist and author of Who Owns Britain, Kevin Carhill. Hi, Kevin, and welcome to Drive Time again.
Hi. Hi,
now,
everyone.
First of all, Kevin, I mean, I like to sometimes have someone who's outside politics to get their angle on the news rather than politicians. I just wonder what your thoughts are about the differences and the similarities between journalists and politicians and their view of the world, and whether it's really possible in this day and age for journalists to be truly independent thinking. And the same with politicians.
No, there's a kind of symbiotic relationship between journalists and politicians. They both need each other and they feed off each other. Journalists are not effective at putting their view. Ultimately, the way I see it, journalists wind up giving the view of the politicians in the end. There isn't independence.
Well, that's kind of correlates with what the former, he used to be the MEP, Conservative MEP for the South West, Richard Cotterill, was saying about there really being no investigative journalism going on in Britain. Now, that's a very extreme point of view, but what's your view of the way that investigative journalism's changed over the last, say, 20, 30 years?
The single one person who destroyed investigative journalism was Rupert Murdoch. He should be seen for what he is, an ogre. The Sunday Times investigative journalism doesn't exist. They come up with some good stories, but investigations, you know, taking time, doesn't exist. But there are some places, I mean, the Exaro website's had a few goodies, and there are places, but there's nowhere to get published. This is the big problem.
Now it's easy, very easy for you to blame Rupert Murdoch, but he's only one newspaper. Now, if other newspapers, surely they can go and do investigations and increase their circulation, then the Sunday Times will start dying off as a paper that's used by people every Sunday.
The Sunday Times has become essentially a feature newspaper. Murdoch discovered that you could actually keep your readership with features. This is really what the paper does nowadays. But just think about it. The four major print groups in this country are owned by offshore tax dodgers. There's going to be a limit to what appears in the Mail, the News International Group, the Express Group, and the Telegraph. They're all owned by people who are not paying the same taxes as everybody else.
But surely they are in a circulation war. They will publish things if they think it's going to increase their circulation, if it's going to be a hot story, and if it's going to gain them credibility as a brand.
Well, investigative journalism does. I mean, it's brought enormous rewards for The Guardian. But the other four don't seem to think it matters. They're not investing in it. And they won't publish stuff that takes... a mutual friend of ours was at a party the other night, and two senior editors from one of the offshore groups, we won't name it, said for an investigative story is 6 hours and an ordinary story is 2 hours. I mean, you can't do anything in that kind of... It becomes comment, not investigation.
Now, you're best known for your investigations into land ownership, really, here in Britain, and particularly the book Who Owns Britain. Just give us a some ballpark figures. One of the things we never hear about, and it frustrates me terribly, is that we don't hear about the idea of landlessness, because it's a massively important thing. If you don't have any property, then you really are absolutely beholden to the employers, the benefit system, and all this kind of thing. We don't really want that. Nobody really wants that. And we've got plenty of land, really, for everybody. There's a lot of space in the country. So, for example, what proportion of people in Britain are now landless?
1% of the population owns more than 70% of the country. But the more important fact is that the maximum amount of land occupied by people in the whole of the United Kingdom is less than 10%. 90% of the United Kingdom is non-urban. You know, it's mountains, it's countryside, all sorts of things. And there's tons of space. So why are we all in shoeboxes, and why isn't more council housing? Almost everyone accepts that more council housing is needed urgently, but nothing is being built. The private housing sector, the prices are going up because nobody's building houses.
Well, they are. I mean, people are building some houses. But I mean, let me just take you back to the point about a lot of rural land, because surely that's one of the reasons people like this country, is actually because we do have quite a lot of open spaces, rural land. We don't want to be building all over it.
Not all over it, but, you know, you don't need to. If 62 million of us manage to park ourselves on less than 10%, expanding slightly is not going to do serious harm to 90% of the landscape. You've got to, you know, you've got to strike a balance. And this thing about keep off the rural land, I feel it's misstated. There's plenty of land, and we don't need to cover every acre or anything else, but we do need to make more land available for homes.
What about these feudal classes? You're talking about the 1% of the people owning how many percent of the land was it?
So over 70%.
Over 70%. Now, how long have they had those landholdings? Because I do get the impression, and we had a discussion with Simon Fairley a few weeks ago, that we are still in this feudal country where many of these big 1% landowners, they've had their land for hundreds and hundreds of years.
I'm doing a doctorate at the moment on land ownership in Devon. And if you wanted to be a big landowner in Devon, you needed to arrive early, before 1130, 1130 AD. The great estates were largely created in the 100 years after the Norman Conquest and have stayed there ever since. The names have changed, very often through female succession. You know, somebody marries an heiress and you put two estates together and so on. That's been the commonest way. But the underlying great estates were mostly formed in the 12th and 13th.
But surely these people are losing their estates with death duties, this kind of thing. I mean, that's one of the things we hear, you know, as soon as you die, there's a massive taxation, super tax, or whatever you call it, and you're going to lose your estate. The state takes it off and then sells it, perhaps, or taxes you.
Doesn't happen. The majority of estates are in trusts. Trusts never die, so there's no inheritance tax. The family who live on the estate are tenants for life. Nobody's ever discussed this either.
Now, as a landowner and a tenant, one of these feudal landowners, are they better generally or worse than, say, your local council as a landlord?
The state is a huge landowner in the United Kingdom, the Crown and the estate. Well, the Crown owns everything. It really is a feudal state in legal terms. The principle of the feudal system was the sovereign owned everything and hired it out to big tenants, and they hired it out to smaller tenants and so on, till you got to the peasants at the bottom who didn't get anything. And that hasn't changed.
Okay, we go back to that original question, though, landlessness. Roughly what proportion of the country are paying rent or homeless? Because it's quite a lot. I mean, they're in the several hundreds of thousands homelessness. Yep. I mean, just in this city, something between 15 and 20,000 people registered or unregistered as homeless.
And it's rising very sharply. But about 65% of homes in the country are privately owned. The other 35% are split between council, housing associations and private. But there's a gap for the homeless. But you could say that 65%, this is why it's so difficult to get movement on anything. 65% of the population have a stake in land. They have a stake in their home. And no politician is going to seriously threaten that.
Well, the bank might, though, might they? They might say, no, you're not having your home, we're having it.
Yeah, but the banks, you know, the repossessions and everything is disgraceful. You know, in America, when they did their great expansion in the 1860s, the banks could seize your farm, but they couldn't seize your homestead. The Americans recognized that you had to have a roof over your head that couldn't be seized by a bank.
Well, we're going to be talking after 6 o'clock to people helping with the homelessness situation, particularly those providing food. We heard this week, Martin, that we've got 70 people in the city centre sleeping homeless. Is there anything that can be done about this situation? Kevin, they're pointing out, you know, you've got to be around, what did you say, 1060 or 1030?
1130 AD.
This is just after the Norman invasion, in order to actually get your hands on some decent slices of land in Devon.
Well, yes, and there are questions about land ownership which have been there for centuries, and there are questions about housing policy which have been come to a head in the last 20 or 30 years.
I mean,
we haven't built any council houses in a generation.
For example,
and then we wonder why we've got all these people sleeping on the streets. It's pretty obvious.
For example,
really, isn't it?
In South Africa, this has come up just over the last few weeks again. The lack of distribution of land, but there are obviously practical things involved. The fact of the matter, though, is if you're landless, you're really fighting a losing battle, aren't you, to try and get your wages or get your benefits in order just to simply survive. You need money to survive.
Well, I mean, the dispossession of the proletariat in Britain happened a long time ago, and if we were to, people were to get land, they'd be getting it back after a long interregnum, let's put it that way. I mean, you could argue that before the Norman Conquest, land was held in common, but I don't think it was. It was just a different, less concentrated feudal setup. But in the developing world, clearly, the whole question of landlessness is still at the top of the agenda all over the world, and it's going to carry on being so, because in many countries, having a viable small farm sector, if you like, is the first step to industrialisation and modernisation. And in countries like South Africa, where the land is concentrated in the hands of the few, the basic steps towards a modern society can't be taken.
It seems like you've got something like 45% of the people basically surviving day to day under the threat of eviction and coercion. But anyway, let's just focus down on one particular story this week. The Bristol mayor last weekend was urged not to evict people over the bedroom tax. Campaigners against the proposed bedroom tax gathered on College Green. Bristol Mayor George Ferguson will today be urged to continue with a no evictions policy over council tenants, just reading from the Bristol Post here, who fall into arrears because of the so-called bedroom tax. Tenants lose £12.70 a week in housing benefit if they're judged to have one bedroom more than they need, or £23.90 a week if they have two bedrooms too many. Since the controversial tax was introduced in April, it's believed that more than 1,000 tenants have fallen into arrears. The latest council figures suggest the amount of arrears has now run up to £750,000, Kevin.
Yeah, no, I think the bedroom tax, and that's what it should be called, although I can't remember what the government's trying to call it, is absurd. Historically, we had things like window tax and hearth tax, which broadly applied to the peasantry. You know, and if you have 20,000 acres, you're not going to be worried about a windows tax, you know, even if you have 200 windows. But this intruding into people's homes is absurd. It's, you know, you have Duncan Smith claiming it's, you know, beneficial. It isn't. It's created incredible hardship from what I've read.
Martin.
Well, I totally agree with that. And in actual fact, it's not even going to save money. This is the crucial thing, because if these people are evicted, they will end up in the private rented sector, in which the rents for a single room are more than for having two rooms in the social housing
sector.
Doesn't
it also cost the council several thousand pounds to evict them?
Well, indeed, you've got to go through the whole process of evicting people. And don't forget, many of these people, if they're in social housing, they're vulnerable anyway, because social housing doesn't go to anybody else these days. So they're often likely to be disabled and what have you. And when you've evicted them, you're then going to find that you've actually got to, they will then go into private rented accommodation or onto the streets. But if they're going to private rented accommodation, their rent will go up, and then housing benefit will have to pay that. Now, ultimately, this is adding insult to injury. I mean, we've got a rubbish housing policy anyway. We haven't built any decent social housing for a generation, which is absurd. And then on top of that, they come and kick the door down and say, what little you've got, we're going to take that off you as well. They know that they can get away with this because these people find it very difficult to fight back. But ultimately, I think people are going to see through all of this, especially if there is another property crash in this country, which I'm afraid predict pretty it's definitely going to happen. That's what we're on.
Kevin,
the road
what
for.
Do you think of that?
Well, the if you want a stable society, the first thing you do is provide stable housing.
Absolutely.
Whether through the state or privately or whatever. Nobody noticed when Thatcher started selling off the council housing, that the house building industry virtually collapsed, because people weren't buying houses, they were buying the ones they were sitting in, which should have been replaced. But as Martin's just said, they weren't replaced. The money that was raised was not, the councils weren't allowed to use it for housing. But what's the phrase from Hamlet, Polonius's phrase? Security is mortal's chiefest enemy. It's the exact opposite. Mm. Security is the most important component of a stable state. And the first security is security of where you live.
Well, there's some apparently good news on the horizon, because those who need to pay the bedroom tax might find it a little bit easier to get a job, since unemployment has fallen. So let's go to Westminster to the last Prime Minister's questions of the year, and Ed and Dave.
Mr. Speaker, today's economic figures show a welcome fall in unemployment. And for every person that gets back into work, it benefits not just them, but their family as well. Does he agree with me, however, it's a major challenge for Britain that at the end of this year, there are more people than ever before in today's figures working part-time because they can't get the hours they need?
Well, first of all, I think it is worth looking at these unemployment figures in some detail, because I think they do paint an encouraging picture. Unemployment is down by 99,000. The number of people claiming unemployment benefit has actually fallen by 36,000 in this month alone. There are 250,000 more people in work. Youth unemployment is down. Long-term unemployment is down. Unemployment amongst women is down. We have talked before about 1 million more people in work under this government. It's now 1.2 million more people in work. Now, there shouldn't be one ounce of complacency, because we've still got work to do to get our country back to work. And everyone back in work means greater stability for them, greater ability to plan for their future, greater help for their families. But the plan is working. Let's stick at it and get unemployment down even further.
Mr. Speaker, he didn't really answer the specific question I asked. It's good our economy is creating more jobs, but the problem is that too many of them are part-time or low-paid or insecure. Now today's figures show what's happening to wages. Does he agree with me it's a matter of deep concern that at the end of this year, average wages are £364 lower than they were a year ago and over £1,500 lower than they were at the general election?
So, yes, sorry to cut that off a bit short there. But, Martin, the figures there are fairly indisputable. But, again, we have this situation where the Prime Minister's questions, this is what it's called, the Prime Minister doesn't actually answer the question.
Well, that was a relatively civilised exchange compared to some of the ones we listened to.
But it's diversionary tactics. A lot of it seems to be just diversionary.
Well, I think the problem for the Labour front bench is that they don't want to be seen to be saying that the recovery isn't taking place. There is a recovery taking place of sorts. I think the figures are disputable. I know, just anecdotally, I know several people who are supposedly on working tax credit. That means that they are self-employed and therefore not counted in the unemployment figures. But in actual fact, they are unemployed. I know they are. That's the reality.
But you say, surely these unemployment figures are an indication that there is actually a real recovery.
I saw Diane Abbott speaking on this week on Sunday, and she was saying that the housing market in London is rocketing, and therefore we are seeing the kind of recovery that Tories like, which is a recovery driven by property prices, particularly in the southeast of England. They've managed to do that. Basically, they've been saving money, as it were, through austerity to this point, and now, of course, they've lobbed a lot of red meat to the housing market to get themselves re-elected.
But you've got unemployment down, property prices up, and what are you complaining about?
The problem is that we've got
QE. This is a recovery.
No, it's not, because don't forget, both in the US and in Britain, this is all based on quantitative easing. And without quantitative easing, the recession, the quantitative easing, let us remember, which was supposed to go on for a few months while the banks sorted themselves out, is now wall to wall. Now, ultimately, there is going to be a crash. It won't just be a property crash in the southeast of England, although that will be part of it. It's going to be a crash in the derivatives market, which will smash the capitalist hegemony that we've had for the last 30 years to pieces. But of course, what we will get on the other side of that isn't a socialist utopia. It's going to be chaos. I'm not looking forward to it.
Kevin, what's your thoughts about the figures, unemployment figures down this week?
I think roughly what Martin, wages are. Average wages are down.
Yeah.
There are far too many part-time insecure jobs. But Martin, I just feel, don't call it quantitative easing. It's just printing money. Ordinary people don't understand what quantitative easing. God, I hardly understand.
That's why they've invented the name, isn't it?
Yeah, they're just printing money. And
if
normally,
they're printing money, how come we're not seeing it? How come the wages are going down?
Because the connection is distant.
Yeah.
You know, printing money doesn't reach people.
Where does the money go
it
then?
Goes into asset prices, Tony. Yeah. So asset prices have been rising. What I would argue is that asset prices have been rising as a result of these money printing policies. In other words, the assets of the wealthy classes have been protected by government intervention. They're also using government intervention to drive down the wages of those they employ.
If you look at Philip Beresford's rich list in the Sunday Times, you'll notice that right through the recession, the asset wealth, which is primarily what he measures, the asset wealth of his 1,000 richest has risen sharply.
That's right.
So the money is going into the kind of assets they hold, property, bonds and these things. And it just doesn't reach ordinary people at all.
Well, it does eventually. This is why we've got some recovery in the economy, Tony. But also, of course, they've actually stopped the austerity to a certain extent. They've decided that they're going to reduce the deficit over a longer period.
What are you talking about? We've got £90 million worth of cuts in Bristol. That's not stopping the austerity.
No, but what they've done is they've said that they're going to get the deficit under control in the same sort of time scale that the Labour Party said that they would get the deficit under control at the last election. So in other words, they've finally agreed that that probably was the best course of action, especially if it gets them re-elected. So if they were to carry... I mean, I would suggest if they're real free marketeers like the Von Mises Institute, let's cut off life support to the banks in Britain and the US and see what happens. Let's go for the free market solution. But that means that the assets of the wealthy classes will have to be collapsed. That is the market solution.
Well, surely that's not going to be allowed to happen, is it?
No, it's not. But then let's not talk about market solutions for anything then. We've got socialism for the rich and crypto-fascism for the poor, it looks like.
That's not bad. But the London property market is substantially being driven by foreign money.
Yes, and of course you're getting flight money as well coming from places in problems. Yeah. So the oligarchs of the world put their money in Kensington in London because it's a way to keep it safe away from people who might take it off them.
One thing that really frustrates me is that for most of us, a house is something where we need to live. For these people you're talking about, Martin, it's just an investment, isn't it? They're quite happy to see it empty so long as it stays there and they can cash it in whenever they want.
Well, exactly. I mean, what's happened is that the idea is, after the crash of 2008, that the state stepped in and bailed out the private markets, and the understanding was that eventually the private markets would get on their feet and everybody else would be re-employed by the private markets. So that's kind of happening. But don't forget the amount of money that's been pumped in to do that. And if there is a crash, of course, we won't get any of that back. And suddenly people will realise actually the state hasn't got any resources at all because they're all in the Cayman Islands. Now, at that point, we send the Royal Navy to the Cayman Islands. Ha ha.
You know, this was one of the great tragedies when Gordon Brown became Prime Minister. Years before, he'd actually got me to do some work for him on the offshore, the Caymans and all this sort of stuff, because we were losing, say, 50 billion a year to the Jersey, the Caymans and so on. And yet he was Prime Minister for 2.5 years and he did nothing. But I believe the people who stopped him doing anything actually were the Americans. I don't know the detail. But is there time for... I met Dennis Healey once, and I said to him, why didn't you do something?
This is the former Labour Chancellor.
Yeah, former Labour Chancellor. I said to him, why didn't you do something about the offshore scam? And Dennis said, the day after I became Chancellor, a man in a suit came into my office and said he was MI6 and I couldn't close down the offshore tax havens. It was a national security issue.
Well, why would that be, Martin? A national security issue, anyway?
Because they need slush funds to do things with, and the Cayman Islands is the best place to do it.
But surely MI6 surely can have their slush funds, but we don't have to have a... assuming they need them, we don't have to open the doors for everybody to keep
their tax. Well, the question is, who is MI6 serving? I mean, Hambro's Bank in the city has got plenty of ex-MI6 people on its board and has for many years, that there's a linkage between the intelligence and security apparatus, the moneyed classes in general, and of course there's also the political system where people get elected, which is basically for show.
Okay, well, let's go back to Westminster now and look at in the real world. There's David Cameron going back to his home, having a nice time, and what's called a Christmas chillax versus those who are having to live through Christmas under benefit sanctions.
Gordon Marsden. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. As the Prime Minister sits down for Christmas dinner to chillax with his family and friends, will he spare a thought for my Blackpool constituents and 500,000 others whose Christmas is mired in the incompetence and random cruelty of DWP's benefit sanctions?
Yeah.
My casework on this includes the woman denied JSA for doing voluntary work at one local branch of a national charity rather than another. Will his New Year resolution be resolving this chaos on sanctions and universal credit?
I,
think the best thing we can do for his constituents, and indeed everyone's constituents, is keep on with the economic plan that is generating more jobs in our country. If we look at the Northwest, the number of people employed is up by 37,000 since the election. Unemployment has fallen by 29,000 since the election. We need to keep on with that, while of course making sure that the benefit system works for people who need it. But he doesn't do his constituents any favours by talking down the performance of the economy.
Well, I mean, he's not really answering that particular problem there, Kevin Cahill, about these kind of random way, these benefit sanctions. He was giving an example there of somebody who was doing voluntary work at one branch instead of another branch of a national charity.
One of the problems here, that if the Tories don't kill the economy, the bureaucracy certainly will. Because there's a bureaucratic problem here. There are people making decisions over people's lives who shouldn't be. You know, too much power has gone into the bureaucracy as well as everything else.
Well, I know. I mean, when I was signing on, I was sanctioned, and it took quite a long time. I think probably about six months altogether. But eventually an appeal came through, which I actually went along to the appeal and I won it. The woman just said, yes, of course, you know, sir, you've won the appeal. Mm. But I mean, for a lot of people, this is incredibly psychologically wearing, Martin, isn't it? And some of those people are the most vulnerable in our community.
Well, that's right. I mean, it's the we really need to rethink our attitude towards the welfare state. And by that, I do not mean we've got to get rid of it. We've got to modernise it and change our attitude towards it. In Switzerland, they're having a referendum sometime soon on having a citizen's income. In Cyprus, they're talking about bringing in a citizen's income. Now, this is like a universal credit, but it's given to you automatically for being a citizen of the relevant country. And you could, in fact, tie it to things like participation in elections and so on. You either turn up to the ballot box when you're expected to, or you don't get this benefit. People say it can't be afforded. It was originally thought of by Milton Friedman, and he called it negative income tax. So there's plenty of mileage in this kind of idea across the spectrum, and ultimately what you'd create for people is social security, so people, whatever their status, get enough money to live on. And in a modern society like ours, where the economy, capitalism is very good at this, we've got far more stuff now than we had 5 years ago. That's not quite true in Britain, because we're still not as big as we were before the crash. But the point is that there's plenty to go around, we've just got to distribute it properly. And if you don't distribute it properly, capitalism doesn't work. You need rising real wages.
Well, we've got good news this week on unemployment, but that may be about to change as we open the gates over the new year to Romanian and Bulgarian migrants who may well be taking many jobs here in Britain. That subject was touched on again this week on Wednesday at Prime Minister's Questions.
Mr. Philip Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I welcome the Prime Minister's acceptance that something needs to be done to stop the EU migrants accessing British benefits. But would he agree with me that what he's proposing, which will probably be found illegal by the European courts, is really spitting in the wind when it comes to the problem that we face? And that the only way to actually get control of our borders back and control of our benefit system is to leave the European Union?
I don't share my honourable friend's pessimism. The steps that we're taking, including the announcement today that people coming to the UK should not be able to claim benefits within the first 3 months, we're taking these steps on the basis of legal advice and looking very carefully at what other countries in the EU do. I want to do everything possible to make sure that the right of free movement is not abused. There is a right to work in different countries of the European Union, but there shouldn't be a right to claim in different countries of the European Union. Where I would agree with him is I think we need to do more in future, and the lesson we must learn is the mistake Labour made to give unfettered access to our labour market when Poland and others joined the European Union, which led to 1.5 million people coming to our country, was a profound mistake.
So is David Cameron a bigot, Martin, by talking about migrants like that, saying, well, they shouldn't be able to claim benefits when they come to Britain?
Well, I think this is an issue that not just for Britain but all over the world now, because we've got a mobile human population, lots of people thinking in terms, and with the crisis as well, people not wanting to share whatever facilities and resources that they have. But I would say to people who think they're going to get any better by leaving the European Union, Norway's outside the European Union, but they pay more per head into the European budget than we do. And that is because the deal is that they don't get access to the European market unless they do so. So we could leave Europe, and that's the EU, but then the EU would say, right, well, you don't get access to our market without tariffs on your goods. unless you pay us more than you're paying now into the EU budget. And that's the Norwegians have realised, because they've got a relatively...
But the Norwegians do, as a result, have control over their borders.
Oh, they do. They do indeed have control over their borders. But they don't. The other thing is that you don't just leave the European Union and carry on trading with the European Union on the same terms. That's not what it's about.
Kevin, what's your thoughts about this opening the borders to Romanian and Bulgarians over the new year?
Clearly the European concept, which is meant to stop, was meant to stop further wars in Europe, that's worked, but some of it was idealistic. The idea of free movement is a lovely idea, but obviously it does need managing. There's no use having the borders of a country with very high unemployment open to everybody. But the thought I have, I stay in a very quiet little military place in Marble Arch, and there's somebody in Romania paying people to come here and make an utter nuisance of themselves right in the middle of the media circus at Marble Arch. In other words, the right are being fed an easy target, because the whole of Marble Arch is full of people who are begging and living in the park, and nobody mentions it, but there aren't public toilets. So it's almost as if somebody somewhere is making it really, really easy, instead of sort of saying the idea was a good one, it needs managing, but not on the principle of fascism, which, I mean, most people don't notice, but a lot of the Tories who are shouting and screaming about immigrants were A, the former imperialists, and B, the descendants of the appeasers.
But aren't we
they
in
all
a situation,
belong to that class.
But aren't we in a situation where, if, by opening all these borders, you end up with actually the lowest common denominator paying conditions around Europe?
Well, as I say, the original idea was meant to, and in some ways it has worked. I mean, the Polish emigration to Britain has actually contributed to GDP quite a lot. The Poles brought a tremendous work ethic here. But if you're British and working class, you have a problem, because these people can take lower wages than you.
Martin, do you think it's going to be a problem next year, this, or not?
I think it's a problem. It's an ongoing problem, and it's not going to go away. Even if you say you're going to keep these people out, I'd say, well, actually, it's very difficult to keep people out. Borders are porous these days. They just are. The Mexicans are supposedly being kept out of the US. They're not. They can't be. There's millions of them, and they're not going to go away. I mean, and you can huff and you can puff, but they're not going to go away.
Are there two main reasons, though, for migration at the moment and the open border policy? One is that it drives down wages, and that employers rather like that. And also that it keeps props up the price of housing, because it is increasing the demand all the time for housing, Kevin.
These are two of the problems. Labour failed to pick up the working class concern about the competition for jobs. And then the second thing was competition for houses. And that goes back to what Martin's mentioned, the lack of building of public housing, of council houses. There weren't enough houses to go around, so prices jumped up.
Now let's go on anyway to talk about one of the main reasons we got you down here today, Kevin, which is your case against the Americans. You're suing the Americans. Now, which particular Americans are you suing, and why?
The evidence published in The Guardian on the 6th, 7th and 8th of June, and I'm talking about the internal memoranda, not The Guardian story, that published, showed that seven American corporations were being paid by the spy agency of the United States to spy on all their customers. And yep.
So this is part of the Edward Snowden revelations, is it?
I have to say, Edward Snowden provided the hard evidence I took to court.
So this is the interesting thing about this chap, is he sort of, it seems like a kind of innocent little guy, just with his little memory stick there, wandering around the world, going to Hong Kong and Russia and places like that. But what he's done is he's provided some hard evidence of what a lot of us suspected for a long time.
Yeah, that there was mass surveillance going on, and it is not benign. But the key thing is it's been ruled illegal in America. Well, what about us? And why isn't our government defending us instead of you know, threatening the editor?
Aren't we the 51st state of the United States? I thought we were.
Well, this is one of the problems. The establishment think we are and haven't got the guts to stand up to the states. But three groups of people have threatened Alan Rushbridger with being put in a court.
He's the Guardian editor.
Yeah, in the dock on terrorism charges. The Prime Minister has threatened him. The heads of the security services, the three of them, have threatened him. And so have the Metropolitan Police in public. Has nobody noticed? But anyway, to go back to what I did, I got tired of being lied to by these companies. So I picked the three that I have a relationship with, Microsoft, Google and Facebook. And I've issued court proceedings against all three. And in the case of Facebook, I have applied for judgment. They have failed to enter a defence. So it looks as if I have won my case against Facebook. The others aren't settled, so we won't.
Okay, now, just how does one go about filing a court case like this? What did you do?
I got the evidence out of The Guardian. I got myself 70 quid, and I went to the county court.
Okay, so you basically just get a pair of scissors, chop up a bit of the evidence, and then you go down to the county court, pay your £70, and what do you do then?
Well, then either they enter a defence, which Microsoft has done, the Google one's caught up in something else, or you don't enter a defence like Facebook, and I get my £1,000. But the real reason I brought the case was to get an order from the court to make Facebook and the other two companies produce the illegal, and they are totally illegal, instructions they got from the National Security Agency.
Now, those instructions, surely the National Security Agency would have to go through the courts in the United States in order to get them to hand over information.
Ah, this is the catch. The United States has got a law called the Foreign Surveillance Intelligence Act. Attached to that act are some secret courts.
Hang on, these are the FISA courts, aren't
these
they?
These are the FISA courts.
FISA, FISA
yeah,
courts, yeah.
Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. These are secret courts. So, let's say one of the companies said to me, no, we always act only on court instructions. What they didn't say was which court, where. Instructions issued by a secret American court are unlikely to be lawful in the United Kingdom, and in actual fact, they're extremely unlawful. They breach the Data Protection Act, the Human Rights Act, and what has got the establishment petrified is they breach the Official Secrets Act. Oh dear. And nobody knows.
So are you saying, for example, communications of military people in this country would have been handed over by Facebook or Microsoft to the NSA?
Let's stick
is that
with
what you're suggesting?
Yeah. Right. That is what I'm saying.
Now, as you were just saying there, you've had basically no response from Facebook, but you have had a response from Microsoft. What are you allowed to tell us about what they've said, either of them?
Okay. Can I switch to a case which is public, because the case with Microsoft is, you know. Google have entered a defence in the High Court that they can't be sued because they're from America. So if you have a problem with Facebook, you have to go to California to sue them. One of the oldest principles of English common law is if you're selling a product in the United Kingdom, you're liable here. And the person who's liable here is the distributor or whoever is. You do not have to go to California.
But Google doesn't sell its product. It's there for free.
They make you sign up and give the consent to the cookies. But this isn't really the problem. The Data Protection Act prohibits the transfer of any data. You know, the issue of whether it's free or not has got nothing to do with it. Any data that people collect on ordinary people in the United Kingdom cannot be transferred abroad legally. And this Google was picking up everybody's data and shipping that back to this huge intelligence agency.
So the fact that Facebook haven't entered a plea, does that mean you've simply won the case? What happens
now? It means
now?
I've got judgment and I've just applied for it. So I'm hoping to get my £1,000, and if they don't give it to me, I shall knock on their door with a TV camera crew with me and demand their desks.
So where does this £1,000 come from? How did you estimate
that? Lots of the Americans have said, why didn't you sue them for millions? And the answer is, an English county court is not going to accept that Google have done me millions in damages, but they are going to accept a reasonable estimate of what shipping my data to the United States illegally is by way of damages, and £1,000 sounds reasonable to me.
But I mean, if it is illegal, this is a criminal offence. Surely people should have been arrested.
The information commissioner should have acted months ago. And Geoffrey Robertson, one of our most eminent QCs, has actually called for prosecutions and arrests.
So how is it that that hasn't happened? Why is that?
Because there's a problem. There are a range of people. The head of the intelligence system in Britain isn't, you know, Sir something or other. It's the Prime Minister. And it's the Prime Minister's job to stop, you know, foreign intelligence services operating in this country. It puts David Cameron on the spot, but it also puts the whole establishment on the spot, because they're the people who are supposed to be patriotic and everything. And what instead has happened is they have stood idly by while this country has been stripped naked of all our personal data.
Martin, what are your thoughts about this challenge? Because there seems to me there's a kind of blurring of the lines, again, a little bit like the EU stuff we were talking about before, of the, is Google an American company? Is it an international company? Is it, you know, is it suable in Britain or not? But I suppose the main principle here is this information, including probably the most incredible allegation that Kevin's making there, is that certain information which could be classed under the Official Secrets Act has simply been handed over to the United States by these companies.
Well, I mean, the fact is that it looks like, and these kind of legal challenges are making it clear, that a lot of what they've been doing is illegal under existing law. They do a lot of other illegal things as well, but we'll leave that put that on one side for the time being, because in actual fact NATO intelligence services have a track record of illegal behaviour, and we're not just talking about bugging people. And in a way, you see, the creation of the Police Service of Northern Ireland in the north of Ireland there was part of a deal whereby it was, you know, in other words, the police force had to be reformed. Everybody has to accept a new set of rules, a new set of regulations. And the point is that we've got to get these intelligence services out of the setup, because they are, in fact, a menace. And they need to be investigated properly by genuine police officers, and a lot of people, just like bankers, will have to go to prison.
Well, the police don't really seem to be interested in investigating or prosecuting those from GCHQ or the National Security Agency.
Well, they should be, and if they're not, then we have to move to a different way of looking at it, don't we?
When I started this investigation against Microsoft, Google and Facebook, the Cabinet Office told me it was the job of the police to investigate them, you know, if there was a criminal allegation. And so I made the allegation to the Metropolitan Police on the 29th of July. And instead what we get is the Assistant Commissioner threatening the editor of The Guardian, revealing in public what's going on inside an investigation. Further, she used what she knew, if you like, as a police officer, to threaten someone else in public. So why haven't they investigated the other allegation that their own bloody data,
Just let me apologise to listeners for
apologize,
the swearing.
Sorry. Yeah. But it's quite possible that the Metropolitan Police have lost all their data. You know, and think where that goes to. But the key thing is, if it's American, nobody seems interested in investigating. They're all going around threatening editors and people.
Something that strikes me as very odd is they've spent billions probably developing these security systems, and frankly radicals like myself have been aware of this echelon has been existing for years. We know they've been bugging the phones and all the rest of it. This is just the proof. But they've got a 27-year-old subcontractor who walks out of the building with one MP3 in his pocket, and the Russians have got the lot. Can't you see what's wrong with that, just from a practical point of view? The Russian secret services, by the way, are now going back to paper files with top secret on them, as you would. Looks like the Iraqi resistance worked out early on not to use mobile phones, and they did a very good job of driving the Americans out. Yeah. They succeeded.
Right, but I think that there is one quite important point. A country like ours has to have a secret service to, you know, keep
Nobody
an eye on our enemies.
Be.
No, we have to, but we have to have one that operates within the law. And we have to have one that notices when a other foreign intelligence service is not only spying on our military, but spying on the whole population, everybody. Mm. Between the American companies involved in this spying have pretty well got handed over the data on the entire British population to a foreign intelligence service.
And they are a foreign intelligence service as well. I'll just mention.
Yeah, but they're our allies, aren't they, Martin?
No, but the point is, countries don't have allies, Tony. They have interests. And Britain's interests are not necessarily the same as the United States. Definitely not, I would say. I mean, in Italy, the head of the Supreme Court, Fernando Imposimato, wrote a book that came out at the end of this time last year entitled La Repubblica dei Strani Impuni, The Republic of the Unpunished Massacres. And he was the investigating magistrate of many of the terrorist attacks in Italy in the 70s and the 80s, and his unequivocal conclusion is that NATO intelligence services were behind those attacks, and it's based on years of investigation by the Italian police.
Well,
it is the Americans. It is the Americans. The Italian secret services are run from London and Washington. SISMI is a part of the NSA MI6 universe. Well, and this, in other words, to control Western Europe, the Americans have been engaging in spying and terrorism over the last 30 or 40 years, according to the head of the Italian Supreme Court.
Okay, well, one of the revelations today, or the latest repercussions of the Edward Snowden revelations, is that a White House Intelligence Task Force report has been out, and journalists over in the United States have been poring over that, many, many pages of it, and one called Trevor Trim, they believe, may have spotted a big one. In the recommendation concerning increasing security and online communications, one point sticks out like a sore thumb. Governments must not use their offensive cyber capabilities to change the amounts held in financial accounts or otherwise manipulate the financial systems. Now, what they're saying there is that not only do they have intelligence which may be to do with terrorism, they also have people's personal bank account login details and this kind of thing, and that they could possibly hack into bank accounts, move money around willy-nilly.
Well, no, it's much more serious than that. What if the full evidence is correct? What the American intelligence system has acquired is all the data on all the bank accounts of the British population. You know, why? They can't. I mean, does John Smith in Acacia Avenue, Northumbria, have to worry?
Well, they're worried, I suppose, about money laundering.
If you have that much data, you can manipulate.
Yeah.
This is what it's about. It's about manipulation. Sorry,
if you've got that much data, you can then get algorithms to go through it and work out who everybody is, what's going on. You're building up a pattern that, you know, it's like the Stasi tried to do with the sort of technology they had in East Germany, where they had to actually put a physical bug in the room. And
that was interesting to hear Angela Merkel. Did you hear Angela Merkel this week saying that the NSA is mimicking the activities of the Stasi?
It's worse than the Stasi. The Stasi were using old technology.
Yeah, and they could only target. But the people who really need to worry about what has happened are people like journalists, political activists, because one of the things the United States was doing with all this data was scanning it for dissidents or people who were critics of American policy. They can now find everybody who doesn't agree with American
policy. They cross-check that against what porn websites they use. Yeah. They've admitted that, which is standard procedure. That's what I'd do if I was them. And, of course, that means if a politician starts to complain about a US policy or whatever, they can say, you wouldn't want people to see this, would you? And that's how it works.
It's a sort of form of a little blackmail file, isn't it?
Forgive me for making it so clear, but this is what the News of the World was doing to Parliament.
Indeed. And in other words, they were running a supposedly rogue intelligence operation as a newsroom. But all of these things interlink together.
Indeed.
So the NSA no doubt gives the News International tip-offs when they want somebody taken down, like Tommy Sheridan was in Scotland. Yep. You know, yep. So he goes to
Swingers Club. This is the leader of the Scottish Socialists.
Yes, he goes. But eventually, the Glasgow police started investigating News International, even though it was. I mean, Tommy Sheridan did, it was silly. He tried to deny that he'd been going to swingers clubs. Because what he should have just said is, "Yes, I do," and then he would have been all right.
Okay, now one person that really does know about this is the former MI5 officer Annie Machon, and she was on Rush Today this week, so let's hear what she had to say about her thoughts about the latest Edward Snowden revelations.
I don't think it's a case of which political party is in power. The government just rolls on and will do what it wants, and the spies have massive leverage over the governments. It's a bit like saying, oh, the bad old days of George W. Bush's presidency. Obama comes in and he'll get rid of all these terrible things that Bush has put in place, like Guantanamo Bay. And in fact, Obama is far worse. Now he has presidentially signed kill lists that the CIA present to him based on flimsy evidence. Britain is probably feeding information in about supposed jihadist suspects, no doubt about that, because the relationship between the US and the UK spies is incredibly close. A bit like with this notional parliamentary oversight, which is the Intelligence and Security Committee, which is not a parliamentary committee. It's appointed by the PM, it reports to the PM, and the PM can vet its findings if he doesn't like them. So all this is done very much in secret. The politicians have to take on trust what the intelligence agencies tell them. And the politicians keep coming out and saying, we know what they're doing because we have to sign this and we have to sign that, and they brief me every week. But actually, I know from the inside how easy it is for the spies to lie to their notional political masters. And they do, and they get away with it because there is no way of their knowing they've been lied to. They can have secret courts. The fact that they have culturally shifted from the 1990s, where they did not use torture, to now being complicit in it. And the reason in the 1990s they didn't use torture was vaguely ethical, but actually it's based on experience from the Civil War in Northern Ireland in the 70s and 80s when they had done. And they realised it was counterproductive. It created blowback, it created a whole new generation of very angry people who potentially could become terrorists. That is what we're seeing again across the Middle East and Central Asia. So it was a pragmatic decision, it was an ethical decision, and it's been overturned since 9/11. We in the West have spent 500 years building up this canon of fundamental rights for human beings, not to be extrajudicially murdered, not to be tortured, not to be disappeared into a prison, to have the right to freedom of expression, freedom of association, freedom of thought, freedom of conscience. All these things have taken centuries to build up, but by creating fear of the unknown nebulous terrorist, then suddenly people are happy to trade their liberties for security, which of course is not working out. And one of the fundamental basic human rights is privacy, because if you lose that, you lose all the others of freedom to ingest information, to communicate information, to plan, to think, everything. And that's why this privacy issue is so fundamentally important.
Well, that's former MI5 officer Annie Machon there. Martin, you know, this is what she's focusing down on here, is saying basically this is an end to privacy. And since all this information is now out there, got by the National Security Agency, there's really not a lot we can do about it, is there?
Well, no. I mean, what worries me is that they're not just spying on people, they're also using this information in order to manipulate political events. I mean, that's pretty obvious, really, what they're doing.
Give us any examples?
Well, I mean, obvious examples is the removal of politicians that they don't like by leaking stories. I mean, Dominique Strauss-Kahn, for example, just off the top of my head, the woman that accused him of rape has actually finally withdrawn the allegation. There was no charges made and all the rest of it.
Yeah, he was the boss of the IMF.
But he's no longer head of the IMF. Now, in other words, they knew Dominique Strauss-Kahn's proclivities and they made sure that they put somebody in his way that would sound credible, and he was removed as head of the IMF so that Christine Lagarde could take over because she was more in line with what Wall Street wanted. There's an example right there. So that's a whole policy change of the IMF by using information which they must have gathered on him by spying on him.
Okay, Kevin, what do you think your case can do, if any, to redress the balance?
You see, Tony, you were saying, what can we do? You can go down to the county court and sue, with a very good chance of paying 70 quid and getting a grand back. And one of the enchanting things, because remember I'm a foreigner, about this country is there is a streak of bulginess here, and I feel that a line has been crossed. And when the British public finally found out the extent to which every secret they had has been nicked, I think the county court queues could be very long. In fact, the American companies had a row with Obama on Tuesday in the White House saying, look, this is what we're facing. So far, they're only facing one case. But Jeffrey Robertson, the QC, raised the issue that that's what we should all be doing. We should all go into court and sue them.
Okay, well, it'd be nice if the Crown did it for us, but if they won't, well, we have to. That's thanks very much to this week's guest. That was freelance journalist and author of Who Owns Britain, Kevin Carhill. After the news, Work and Pension Secretary Ian Duncan-Smith has been slipping out of the chamber as the House of Commons debates food banks this week, leaving his assistant Esther McVeigh to carry the can. And there's nothing, we're told, she can do to put food on our tables except encourage those from cut off from benefits, the disabled and the mentally ill too, to go out and get a job. We'll be join us after the news with Martin Summers as well on the tour of the world's hotspots after the Murdoch news at 6 o'clock.
Online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live. from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 6. Nigella Lawson says her experience as a witness in the trial of her two former aides has been deeply disturbing. Sisters...